Okay. So any questions or comments before we start? Anybody want to say anything here? No? Okay, very good. So if that is the case, we will just continue with the Mahanama Sutta. And so we have had a look at 2 out of 5 recollections, the Buddha Anusati, Dhamma Anusati, Sangha Anusati. And the next one here is called the Sila Anusati. So this is the recollection of your virtuous behavior or your character, if you like. And we've talked about this before, so we can probably go through it fairly quickly. Get it all kind of into context here. Again, Mahanama, a noble disciple recollects his own virtuous behavior as unbroken, flawless, unblemished, unblotched, freeing, praised by the wise, ungrasped, and leading to stillness. When a noble disciple recollects his virtuous behavior, on that occasion his mind is not obsessed by greed, anger, and confusion. On that occasion his mind is simply straight, based on virtuous behavior. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the teaching, gains joy connected with the teaching. When he is joyful, rapture arises for one with a rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. One tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, the mind becomes stilled. This is called a noble disciple who dwells in balance amid an unbalanced population, who dwells unafflicted amid an afflicted population, as one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma. He develops recollection of sila, of virtuous behavior here. So this is, we have seen most of these things here before. We saw all the various qualities of sila previously. So So the idea here again is this idea of the sila being as perfected as possible, right? Unblemished, and the more unblemished it is, and the more complete it is, and the longer the time that you have practiced it, the more power it has to overcome your defilements of the mind. And when you recall that, bang, the defilements are gone, and your mind is straight again, not crooked by the defilements. And then just very often the way to do this kind of thing, often how do we recall our own virtue? And it's important to be very gentle when we do this thing, not to try too hard. If you try too hard to remember the things that you have done, you will spoil it because the mind becomes tense and it doesn't really relax properly. So it's almost like a natural thing when you sit down, the good memories almost come back to you, almost by nature, in a sense. You just sit back, you allow some good memories of good things in the past that you did just to arise without forcing the issue, without trying very hard at all. And then when you do it, when it happens naturally, that is when it is the best kind of joy, because it's a joy which is not tainted by willpower and by all of these other kind of things. So it's a bit like that mountain simile we were talking about the other day. When you sit down at the end of the long day and you rest, and all the mountain of good qualities, the mountain of good things that you have done in the past, it casts its shadow over you, and you feel enveloped and kind of completely immersed in this mountain of good actions. And that is, of course, the beautiful thing about this. Just like the sun going down the mountain, and then the house in front of the mountain being immersed in the shadow, same kind of idea. Then it's very easy, it happens all very naturally and straightforward, and then you feel happy because of you know that your conduct is well, nobody can really blame you, and it just makes you feel good about yourself. Okay, the last one is the recollection of generosity. This is called the Chaga Nusati in the Pali language, and it goes as follows. Again, Mahanama, a noble disciple, recollects his own generosity thus: it is truly my good fortune and gain that in this population obsessed by the stain of miserliness, I dwell at home with a mind devoid of the stain of miserliness, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. And again, when the noble disciple recollects that generosity, his mind is not obsessed by the defilements, it is just straight. And then because it is straight, you gain the inspiration based on the inspiration and the meaning and the teaching. And again, the joy that is connected with the teaching. And from the joy comes the rapture, and then comes the tranquility, and then comes the pleasure, then the mind is stilled. And this is called a noble disciple who dwells in balance amid an unbalanced population, who dwells unafflicted amid an afflicted population, as one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops recollection of generosity. So here you have this idea that you take the generosity all the way to the point where you are freely generous. The stain of miserliness is not in your mind anymore. You're kind of just, giving out without any kind of limits. Of course, sometimes you have to stop yourself because you give too much, right? And you say, wait a minute, I have to kind of look after myself as well. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because this actually happens. There is a rule in the Patimokkha for the monastics that if certain families are too generous, you're not allowed to go to the house to receive food unless you are specifically invited to go to their house. Why? Because they want to give all the time, and then the children don't eat properly and these kind of things. And that's kind of, people go to that extent. And these are people often people who are perhaps stream mentors and who have seen the Dhamma. They just become too much faith and too much confidence in the you can't really have too much faith, of course, sometimes it may actually have bad effect on your other family members. But this is the general idea. When you have that mind state that is so free and so open and so willing to share with everyone, that is the kind of mind state you require for samadhi, because it is a very open, free mind where there's no boundaries, there's no kind of limits, certain people outside, certain people inside. There's this open heart, kindness towards everyone. And you can see why that is so useful for the samadhi practice. So you don't have the stain of miserliness, right? Freely generous, open-handed, delighted in giving up and charity. And this is what this is all about. And when you read the suttas, it is also one of the requirements for entering the stream as well, that you have to have this kind of mindset. And you will see that those people who are Aryas, the stream mentors or others, they are often very generous people. They will give of their time almost without limit. This is one of the qualities of somebody who is a stream mentor or more. Again, when you do this kind of recollection, it's not important not to force it too much. Remember the ideas of generosity. We had some look at generosity before. And the idea is that when you are generous, you want to be generous when you feel inspired to be generous. Because when you are inspired, it means that you are mindful, it means that you feel a sense of happiness and joy in the giving. And when you feel a sense of happiness and joy in the giving, it leaves a very strong impact on your mind. It's very easy to recall later on, right? Because the impact is strong while you give, and afterwards you remember it very easily as well. And then you think back, and it gives rise to a similar kind of happiness when you think back to that afterwards. And this is the idea here. Strong impact in the beginning, easy to recall afterwards, and you feel very joyful as a consequence of that. You know that you have done something positive and good. So this is what you try to do. Anyway, you get the idea here. Don't use too much force on these things. Just allow your mind to go back to a time when you felt joyful because of your kindness, your generosity, your virtue, and these things. And this is how these things kind of come up as a consequence. So, there you are. This is kind of the path leading from sammasati and then eventually arriving at sammasamadhi. So, what I want to do now is to go back a little bit again to the gradual training. So, if you go back again to page 15, and we'll have a look at the very last paragraph in the gradual training. We haven't looked at that yet, so we're going to have a look at that one first of all. So now we are moving from the seventh factor to the eighth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And the movement from right mindfulness to right stillness is what we are seeing here. So, and this is how it reads in the gradual training here. Having thus abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual objects, secluded from unwholesome qualities, he enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. This Brahmin is called the footprint of the Tathagata, something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. But the noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion. The Blessed One is fully awakened, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, the Sangha is practicing the good way. So here, it starts off by saying, having abandoned these five hindrances, you have to abandon the five hindrances to gain either jhana or real insight, all the uttare manusadhamma, the superhuman states, beyond the ordinary, all can only happen when the hindrances are abandoned. Why? Because they weaken the mind, as they say, the weakened wisdom, panya dubali karana, I think the Pali word is, something like that. So the upakilesas, that chittasa upakilesa panya dubali karana, or something to that effect. Upakilesas, these imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom. Wisdom is weak. Why is it weak? Because it is diverted by desire, diverted by ill will, and these things distort reality. This is one of those things that is so important to recognize, that any kind of little desire, any kind of little ill will distorts the world, and it's impossible to actually see it for what it's really like. And you can notice that in your own mind to some extent, certainly when these things are very strong, but remember, it goes all the way to the end. Even if you have a little bit of these things, it distorts reality for you. And this is the problem. So only when these things are completely abandoned can you actually access this superhuman state, the uttari manusadhamma, superhuman qualities, which includes the jhanas and the insights. So once you have abandoned them, then quite secluded from sensual pleasures. Here we have the word kamehi again. Kama is like sensuality in the world. But when this world is used in the plural, it refers to the objects of the senses, or the five senses as such. So what it really means, it means quite secluded from the five senses. This is what that actually means. It's not very obvious that it means that, because the way it is translated, but that's actually what it is referring to. So all five senses disappeared. All you have left is the mind, nothing else. And at the same time, secluded from unwholesome qualities or bad qualities. Secluded from the five hindrances, these are the unwholesome states, right? So when you are secluded from the senses, it is not as if your mind is still, dirt, full kind of bad imperfections, but your mind is also entirely pure. You're not angry inside, you have absolute, all of that is actually completely abandoned. So you can see that this is quite a different state from what we normally experience the world, all the five senses gone. This almost never happens. It's almost kind of unheard of for people. No impurities in the mind. So you can see that this is a very different way of looking at the world from what we're used to. And then it says, he enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought. And this here, again, as I mentioned before, is the very last remnant of vitakka and vichara on the Buddhist path. And vitakka and vichara, in this case, I think it is fairly clear to me that what it means is just a slight, tiny movement of the mind that remains. And the tiny movement is almost like a pulse, like a pulsing of the mind. That's really all it is. And that is all that remains at this particular stage. So the idea of calling it thought here, I think, is not a very good way, not a very suitable translation, really. More like accompanied by applied and sustained application of the mind is what we sometimes translate it as. With rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Vivekaja pittisukha is what this is about. So it's a type of happiness that comes when the mind is secluded. Secluded from what? Secluded from the five hindrances and the five senses. So this is how the first jhana is described in the suttas. And of course, that description by the Buddha is in many ways a very precise description of what it is about. But it's very hard to really guess what it feels like from that description, right? But it gives you a little bit of indication of what you are heading towards and where we're all going here. And then comes this very powerful last sentence here, when the Buddha says to this Brahmin, this is called a footprint of the Tathagata. Right? The idea, when you get to the jhanas, you know that the Buddha was here too, because he also walked through these, passed through the jhanas. This is part of what it is to be a Buddha, to go through these things. You cannot become a Buddha, that's what basically what it's saying, without passing through the jhanas. And that's why they are footprints of the Buddha. So that's kind of, it's imagine coming to these things and feeling that you are almost in the presence of the Buddha. That's what it's saying here. Buddha is almost here. You almost get a feeling for what it's like to be the Buddha. This is what the Buddha does, right? He practices the jhanas. Now you are doing the same thing. It's quite neat, isn't it? It's quite... So you really feel inspired when these things happen. Something scraped by the Tathagata. Something marked by the Tathagata. So the Tathagata, you know you are in the presence, getting very close. Remember this, because sometimes the idea is that samadhi is not sufficient. You still haven't seen the Dhamma. But remember that you're actually getting very close at this point. And this is why. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to call these things the footprint of the Buddha, the footprint of the Tathagata. This is very close. Okay, you're not there yet, but you're getting very, very close at this particular stage. And this is how highly these jhanas are praised in the suttas. They're praised in many other ways too, but this is one of these ways. But still, you do not come to the final conclusion yet, because you haven't actually seen the Buddha. All you have seen is the footstep. And because you only seen the footsteps, then you cannot conclude the Blessed One is fully awakened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good way, because you haven't seen this for yourself. So that is what happens next, is actually becoming, reaching awakening on the basis of the jhanas is the next thing here. So now I want to turn to the very last sutta in this collection, and that is called the Maha Malunkya Sutta. And this is Majjhima Nikaya 64, and it's a very nice sutta, and I would recommend you to have a read of it if you are interested, because... It is quite long. It has much more content than this, but it's actually a very nice little sutta on these specific points. And what the point that this sutta makes, which is very powerful, is that it is impossible to reach full awakening without the jhanas. This is what it is saying, and it shows you that also at the same time the process by which this actually happens. So the Buddha is speaking to Venerable Ananda. There is a path and a way, Ananda, to the abandoning of the five lower fetters. Five lower fetters are the fetters that keep you to this world. These are the fetters that stop you from becoming an anagami, a non-returner. Right? So these are the three fetters of stream entry, the Sakkaya. Silabhata Paramasa, the Vichikicca, and the third one? Sakkaya Ditti, right. And then, of course, we have the ill will and the sensual desire are the two other ones. So those are the five lower fetters that tie you to this world. This world meaning the world of sensual pleasures. So you still have a few fetters left before you become an arahant. That anyone without relying on that path and way might know and see or abandon the five lower fetters, this is not possible. Just as when there is a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, it is not possible that anyone might cut out its heartwood without cutting through its bark and sapwood, so too in the case of the abandoning of the five lower fetters. Right? So sometimes you hear people often discuss this thing, whether it's possible to become fully enlightened without the jhanas and these kind of things. And this is one of those fairly, in my opinion, very strong statements that basically it is impossible. Just as it is impossible to cut out the heartwood of the tree without cutting the bark and sapwood, right? I mean, that sound, it is impossible, right, to get to the heartwood without the other things. So you have to conclude from this that jhanas is absolutely required. The path and the way hasn't been described yet, but that path and the way is the jhanas and also higher aspects of samadhi. There is a path and way, Ananda, to the abandoning of the five lower fetters, that someone, by relying on that path and way, might know and see and abandon the five lower fetters. This is possible. Just as when there is a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, it is possible that someone might cut out its heartwood by cutting through its bark and sapwood, so too in the case of abandoning the five lower fetters. So if you do cut through the sapwood and bark, then you might cut through the heartwood, right? So if you do follow this path, then it may actually happen. Suppose, Ananda, the river Ganges was full of water right up to the brim, so that crows could drink from it. And then a feeble man came thinking, by swimming across the stream with my arms, I shall get safely across to the further shore of this river Ganges. Yet he would not be able to get safely across. So too, when the Dhamma is being taught to someone for the cessation of identity, if his mind does not enter into it and acquire confidence, steadiness and resolution, then he can be regarded as like that feeble man. So you have to be strong before you can cross the river Ganges by swimming. It makes sense, right? Very wide river. And if you are not really strong, and and maybe the current is quite strong as well, you really have to be in good shape, etc., to be able to swim across that one. Otherwise, you'll be in trouble. In the same way, in the Dhamma, you have to be strong. The mind has to be strengthened by the abandoning of the five hindrances and by strengthening the mind further through the seven factors of awakening. The more of those seven factors of awakening that you have access to in your mind, the more easy it is to break through, because the mind is strong. You have the upeka, the ability to observe and look on without being sidetracked, without becoming fearful, without being kind of pulled along by these defilements that often arise. So this is one of the things about samadhi. It strengthens you. You feel really strong inside, ability to deal with almost anything. And that is what this is about. So when the Dhamma is taught to someone for the cessation of identity, so this means like the cessation of seeing an I, feeling that there is a me in there. This is what identity refers to here. Sakkaya is the Pali word. This is not the cessation of Sakkaya Ditti, that's just the view. This is the full cessation of Sakkaya, any sense of identity whatsoever. You don't feel like you identify with the five khandhas at all anymore. So that is why it is so hard, right? Because we're dealing with some of the core aspects of who we think we are. We always want to identify with something. We feel that we exist, and that sense of existence is incredibly dear to us, because that's why we feel that way in the first place. This is me. This is the real me. And of course, to be able to see through that takes a very powerful mind and a very stable mind. Otherwise, you will become fearful because you feel challenged. Your very existence feels challenged in this way. Of course, it's just an illusion, so there's no problem. Once you see through it, you think, wow, why was I holding on to that all along? I was being completely crazy and deluded. Once you see through these things, only then do you understand what a big mistake it was. But still, we are afraid to go there because it feels like we're losing something, when in fact, all we're doing is winning something. What we're winning is true insight, true understanding of the nature of reality. And what we're holding on to is a delusion. So it can only be good to see things according to reality, right? It's never good to hold on to delusions. If you hold on to delusions, you go down the wrong track. You make the wrong decisions because you're not basing, you don't have the real information. So you're basing your decisions on wrong information. It's a bit like investing on the stock market and you have a bad broker who gives you bad information and you lose heaps of money. So if you have the wrong religion, it's a bit like a bad broker, right? And it goes down the wrong track as a consequence. So maybe that's a bit of an unfair similarity, but anyway, that gives you the idea what's going on here. So, if his mind does not enter into it, right, and if you're not entering into it and acquire confidence in all of these things, it's because most likely you are a bit fearful and you don't know why on earth would I want to go this way. And then you are feeble because you don't have that ability to enter into that seeing, that cessation of identity here. But suppose Ananda, the river Ganges, were full of water right up to the brim so that crows could drink from it. And then a strong man came thinking, by swimming across the stream with my arms, I shall get safely across to the further shore of this river Ganges, and he would be able to get safely across. So too, when the Dhamma is being taught to someone for the cessation of identity, if his mind enters into it and acquires confidence, steadiness, and resolution, then he can be regarded as like the strong man. And of course, that strength again, it comes from the samadhi, as we shall see in a second. That's how the strength comes about. So, now, and what, Ananda, is the path and the way to the abandoning of the five lower fetters? Here, with seclusion from acquisitions, with the abandoning of unwholesome states, with a complete tranquilization, tranquilizing of bodily inertia, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome qualities, a monk enters and dwells in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thought, accompanied by sustained initial and sustained application of the mind, with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. Yeah, so this is the path. And of course, this sutta actually goes on quite a bit after this. So after mentioning the first jhana, it also mentions the second jhana, the third and the fourth jhana. And after that, it mentions the first three of the four immaterial attainments as well. That is the path, right? And without entering that path, it is impossible, it says in the sutta, to actually abandon those five lower fetters. It's a very powerful, strong statement on the importance, at least in the end, for becoming a fully enlightened being. You have to abandon, you have to enter these jhana states. So we have, you can see here that the jhana formula is slightly different from last time. Here we have this idea of seclusion from acquisitions. So this means, it's a similar kind of thing. It means seclusion from anything that really belongs to you. And of course, that happens when the five senses disappear. That is when you are secluded from these acquisitions. I think upadi is the Pali word. Upadi means like things that you acquire, sometimes even further than external acquisitions, sometimes also including the five khandhas themselves. A complete tranquilizing of bodily inertia. I'm not sure exactly what that is referring to. I forgot to look up the Pali. Do you know what the Pali is? Oh, okay, we've got the... okay, great. Thank you so much. So, kaya dutulanang patipasadya. Patipasadya means tranquilization. Kaya is the body. Dutulanang is probably any kind of heaviness of the body, any kind of problem with the body, presumably, any kind of negativity, probably refers to defilements and that kind of thing. And kaya here might very well be referring to the mental body as well as to the physical body, I think. I would have to have a more, this is a very rare passage, for that reason the interpretation is a bit dicey, so not entirely sure what that means, but anyway, I think we get a rough idea that it has to do with defilements and a kind of negative feeling of the body. So, that is what you have to do, right? One of the really powerful things. So you have to, ultimately, you have to practice the eighth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path to get to the end of the path. It kind of makes sense, right? If the Buddha lays down eight factors of the path, then surely you have to practice all eight to be able to actually reach the end of the path. Otherwise, why does it include eight factors? The path has eight factors? Okay, so you've got to practice those eight factors. Then what happens? And one of the interesting things about this is that in the suttas, we're always talking about the path having eight factors. But of course, in reality, the path doesn't really stop there. It doesn't stop with the jhanas. We have to go a little bit further. You don't become an arahant necessarily automatically just by having the jhanas. Or maybe you do become an arahant. Maybe you do become a stream mentor automatically. This is kind of the interesting question here. And the answer why sometimes people do not become stream mentors or do not become arahants by practice and the jhanas, sometimes it happens. Sometimes you hear about maybe people in the Hindu tradition, right? Or maybe even the Christian saint in the Middle Ages that may have practiced things that look like they are very similar to the jhanas. How come they didn't become awakened? How come they still believe in God or in Brahma? I have seen the great Brahma. That's what the Hindu sage will say after entering a jhana state. So what is going on? How come the path ends there when in fact some people still have wrong view afterwards? And the reason is that the Eightfold Path is an integrated unit. Remember, the Eightfold Path starts with right view. You have to look at things in the right way at the outset. And if you have wrong view at the beginning, then when you come to the jhanas will be informed. Your understanding of those jhanas will be informed by your wrong view. So you will see them in the wrong way and you will see God, you will see Brahma. Wow, this is so powerful. And this is how powerful these jhanas are, right? That people actually regard these things as the unification with the Absolute, seeing God, seeing the Creator of the universe, and all of these kind of things. That's how powerful they are. So the only way that you can escape that, because when you see something so beautiful and so powerful, you kind of want to attach to that. It's very tempting to say, this is the real me. It is so beautiful. It is so powerful. I would like to be like this. So you take it on board. This is the real me. This is the essence. That's what I really am, right? All those defilements got nothing to do with me. This is the real me. The happiness, the bliss, the joy, the purity, the non-self, and all that kind of things. But because it is so tempting to take it as a self, that is where you have to be very careful. Go back to the beginning of the path, right view, the danger of rebirth, danger of going the wrong place, the understanding of all conditioned phenomena as impermanent and suffering. So what about the jhana? Is that a conditioned phenomena? Of course it is. You have just created it, right? You created it through your practice. So it is a conditioned phenomena. And that's why ultimately it is suffering. Ultimately it is impermanent. Ultimately it has to cease. So you have to contemplate the jhanas in that way. And this is what this very last part of the path is about. So when we get to the jhanas, essentially the path works by itself if you have right view at the beginning here. Okay. So this then is the kind of the exciting grand finale of the whole path of practice. Whatever exists therein of form, feeling, perception, volition, and consciousness, he sees those qualities as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, as a tumor, as a barb, as a calamity, as an affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as empty, as non-self. Right, so this is the first thing of what you do because you have right view. You understand that these things are conditioned. So you contemplate the jhana itself in this way. whatever exists therein, in other words, whatever exists in that jhana state, right, of the five khandhas, the five khandhas I mentioned here, you understand this jhana state in these terms. It is impermanent. It will not last that long. You come out afterwards and then maybe take a few eons before you get back into it next time. That's a long time to wait. And then because of that, you also see it as suffering. All of these words here that come here are just different ways of regarding it as suffering. Suffering, a disease, a tumor, like a cancer. That's pretty harsh, isn't it? Seeing the jhana as a cancer, as a barb, seeing it as a calamity. Now that's really, that takes a lot of insight. As affliction, as alien. So here we're moving on to the non-self aspect, right? Alien means other, got nothing to do with you. Disintegrating, that's back to impermanence again. As empty and non-self. Emptiness and non-self are synonyms. All of this referring to the fact that is not a permanent essence inside of you. Yes, so what you're doing here is that you're seeing the jhana states themselves as subject to the three characteristics: suffering, impermanent suffering, and non-self. And this is incredibly hard to see. Imagine you have just seen the highest bliss that you have ever experienced in your life, right? Absolutely out of this world, quite literally. And as you go through the jhanas, the bliss becomes even higher and greater. You basically, it's so much bliss, you don't really know how you can take all the bliss. And then you're next asked to see it as suffering and as a calamity. That is why this is so quite difficult, right? And why it takes a lot of insight to be able to do this. But this is what ultimately you have to do. How is that possible? And of course, the only way it really is possible is to understand that it is conditioned, is impermanent, it will disappear. And then, of course, after having that jhana experience, you will try the rest of your life to regain it. And that's what people sometimes do. And then because they don't understand how to do that, they misunderstand and they never actually get back there again as a consequence. And then it becomes a bit, difficult to deal with that. So this is essentially how this path works. Now, one of the important points here, what is actually going on here, is that when you get into a jhana state, there is very little left of existence. You have given up almost everything at this point. The five senses are gone. The body is gone. The will is gone. So many things have disappeared already. Most of your perceptions, most of your feelings, all negative feelings, a lot of worldly feelings of happiness, it's all disappeared. And all that is left at this point is this tiny little thing called the first jhana. It's almost nothing. You've already left behind. 99% of samsara is already left behind. This is all that is left. And all those things that you have left behind, the reason why you have been able to leave them behind is because you have already understood those as suffering, as impermanent, and as non-self. So in other words, anyone who gets to the first jhana already has an enormous amount of wisdom, right? You have seen 99% of existence as subject to the three characteristics already. Already your insight is enormous. So now all you have left is this tiny little jhana, this tiny little sphere of existence. And that is why this is focusing on those jhanas. No need to focus on all the other stuff anymore. All you have to focus on now is that jhana experience itself. A tiny, tiny amount of the five khandhas remain, and that is where you put your focus. When as you go through the jhanas, you're leaving behind more and more and more, there is less and less and less of existence left, and it becomes easier and easier to make that final breakthrough, because hardly anything left there for you to hold on to. You get to the fourth jhana, all you have is equanimity, right? All you have is neither happiness nor suffering, adukkha masukha vedana. So all you have to let go of is neutral feeling. It's getting quite easy, right? And the sense of consciousness itself. And so this is what is happening here. This is why how this path works, the gradual abandoning of things. And of course, a very important point is that you already have enormous amounts of insight at this point because you have abandoned so much already. Then, when you contemplate in this way, what happens is that he turns his mind away from those states or those qualities and directs it towards the freedom, the element of freedom from death. Thus, this is peaceful, this is sublime. That is the stilling of all conditioned phenomena, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, and nibbana. So you turn your mind. You don't actually really do very much, because if you contemplate in the right way, it is natural. The mind just turns away by itself. Remember what we were talking about before, the idea of the hand and the hot plate. You walk around your house and somebody has turned on the hot plate. You're not aware of that. You put your hand down, just you're going to rest your hand, and whoa, you pull it back, right? No need to think too much, because if you think too much, it's too late already. You burnt yourself. Oh, should I take my hand away or not? Oh, no. Automatic reaction, because you know suffering. You know this is suffering. It's so obvious. And it's exactly the same thing when you have real insight. When you have real insight and you see suffering, this is why it is called aversion. This is why it's called repulsion. You are literally repelled by it, drawn away, pushed away by it. The mind turns away, because what the mind sees is unpleasant and difficult to bear. And that's why it turns in a different direction. Yeah, so this is what it means here when it talks about these things. These are very powerful things that are happening at this stage. This is why it's called nibbida, the repulsion from all of these things. We're talking about deep insight now, of course, really, really deep insight. And then, because you turn away from that, and you turn it away towards that where there is the freedom from death, because you know that the problem with these jhanas is that they keep you on in samsara. It is not the final end of samsara, and you want to end, make an end of all rebirth as a consequence. And that is why you move towards that reality, that property where there is freedom from death. Here it is translated as the deathless element, which I must admit, I don't think it is the best translation. I prefer just the freedom from death. Remember when the Buddha went forth in the Arya Pariyesana Sutta, the Noble Search, Majjhima Nikaya 26, he says specifically that he goes forth in order to find the freedom from death, and that eventually he does find that freedom from death. And that is what he's found here. So the deathless element, or dhatu is the word for element, can be called property. He discovers the property of freedom from death. It's a particular property of existence. There is no death anymore, right? And you're directed from that, because that you realize that's the only liberation from these things. And then you understand, this is peaceful. Etang santang, this is sublime. Etang panitang, sublime and peaceful. That is the stilling, the ending of all conditioned phenomena. In this case, it probably actually, it has a double meaning. Because the word sankhara here, and the ending of sankharas in terms of the will that produces future rebirth, that is one meaning. That is what the arahant achieves. And then also it refers possibly also to the stilling of all conditioned phenomena when the arahant finally dies and attains the final parinibbana. So double meaning, becoming an arahant and the ending of the arahant when the arahant dies. The relinquishment of all acquisitions means that you don't hold on to anything anymore. You give up everything, even the five khandhas, even the things that are closest to you. So this means, literally means everything, including your own consciousness. You are no longer attached to your own consciousness. When the word relinquishing occurs like this, it doesn't mean that you give it up in terms of not having anything to do with it. It just means you have no craving and attachment to it. You still have consciousness, of course. You still have feelings. It's just that there is no attachment to these things. So a certain thing in the five khandhas has disappeared. The aspect of craving and attachment has disappeared. The destruction, the ending of craving, right? Dispassion, which is viraga, nirodha, and nibbana, which is the final extinguishment of everything else. This is sublime. This is peaceful. All of these things, the end craving has come to a final end, and you know that you will never be reborn again as a consequence of that. And then it says, if he is steady in that, he attains the destruction or the ending of the asavas, and he becomes an arahant. But if he does not attain the ending of the asavas, then through that very desire for the Dhamma, that delight in the Dhamma, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, he becomes one due to be reborn spontaneously in the pure abodes and there attain final extinguishment without ever returning from that world. This is the path and way to the abandoning of the five lower fetters. So the very last part there is that if you delight in that Dhamma, here probably referring back to the jhana states, right? If you still keep a delight in these things, well then you get reborn in the Brahma world, because the Brahma world is precisely where you go if you have some delight in the jhana states. You can't give them up completely, and then you get reborn there. You hang out there, hang out in the jhanas for a few eons, that's right, yeah, a few eons up there. And then when you kind of, okay, enough of these eons in the jhana realm, then you take final nirvana without ever returning from that world. So, this is very profound, right? This is kind of the very end of the Buddhist path. And I'm just saying these things just to maybe inspire you a little bit. Maybe, I'm not sure if you, how much you feel that you understand. Maybe some of you have been Buddhist for a long time, so you probably have some idea what's going on here. But if you are more new, you may think, whoa, this is really over the top, or maybe this is kind of strange or whatever. But it's there to inspire you. The ending of all suffering, the highest happiness attainable by human beings. This is what this is all about. It may seem slightly strange with words like calamity and alien and all of that. But remember, this is a world of profound insight into the nature of reality. And it is all really about happiness at the end of the day. And that is why it is so powerful and so beautiful. And then you have come to the end of the Buddhist path. And what happens when you come to the end of the Buddhist path? Arahantas, right? Well, then you chill, right? Exactly. There's a nice suit. There's a nice in the Theragata. That's a very nice little poem. This is by Venerable Sariputta. Venerable Sariputta says something like, I think he's asked, what is it like to be an arahant? And he says, to be an arahant is like being a workman who is waiting for his wages. Right? So you're waiting. Oh, just waiting for parinibbana. Just waiting to die. And then, ooh, you go off. And then you are even more happy, because then you get rid of this body and all these other problems. And then you have final, ultimate happiness when that happens. So, are you ready for all this? Yeah? So this is the path, right? And what is so nice about is that every step on the path is a degree of happiness, right? Every time you do something right, everything kind of comes together. You feel more happy. Suffering being released. You put down the two bags of the past and the future. Let those go first of all. You feel lighter on this journey. Lighter and lighter and lighter. A lighter heart, a lighter mind. Putting aside all the burdens in life. And whoa, soaring away until one day, who knows, one might even end up like one of these marvelous masters of the teachings, the arahants in the world, or the stream mentors at least, or at the very least having some deep meditation experiences. And if you do that in the right way, so just go slowly, stage by stage, and see what happens. And as you do that, hopefully inspiration will come when you start to feel the workings of this path. Okay, so now we still have a bit of time left, so if you want to discuss certain things, then you can make use of me while I'm still here. I will soon just disappear. Yes, Lei Young.
Ajahn, how could this strong emotion of aversion or repulsion sort of come together with evenness of mind, equanimity, and...
Okay.
It's a very strong... negative emotion.
It is not negative in this case. That's the thing. It is actually, it's just a, It's like when you see suffering very strongly, you feel, oh, I can't take it anymore. It's not a negative in the sense of having anything to do with ill will or anything like that. There's a feeling of, you just have to turn away from it. You can't see it anymore. It's a bit like when you see, for example, a suffering on TV, you talked about the other day, you just have to turn away. You can't deal with it. You don't feel angry about it necessarily. You don't feel upset. You just can't. You just see suffering in a very real way. It's a bit like the hot plate. You just pull back very quickly without any anger or negativity in the mind. It's a powerful turning away, powerful moving away from something. That's really all it is. Yeah.